Accession number 9428, reel 10.
Mr. Keel, reel 10. You were describing your payoff, actually, from DMOB. Can you remember how much you were actually given?
I think, in all, it wasn't much over. It was around about the £50 mark, which took in back pay, ration allowance for a week, and gratuity. The whole thing was about £50. That was for 5 years, blood and guts. About £50.
What did you feel about that at the time?
Very poor. Very poor. But the only thing, optimistic, we were out of the army, we are now going to earn big money. Like bloody hell we did.
Can you remember where you actually were demobbed?
Yes, yes. From France, do you mean? From France, we were sent down to Boulogne for a day or two to get kitted, re-kitted, and hand in a lot of the kit, like rifles and ammunition and all that. And then from there, we were shipped over by boat to I couldn't tell you where in England, but it was no time before we were down to the palace. Can you remember the name?
Crystal Palace?
Yes, I think it was Crystal Palace. Crystal Palace doesn't seem to touch a chord. But anyway, one of those big places. And there we were kitted out with civilian suits and shoes and hats. And that was the end. So you walked in, as I saw so many officers, a full colonel practically, walking in one door and coming out half an hour later with this funny civilian suit. Yeah.
Did you have to have a good job to go to at that time?
No, nothing at all. No, as far as I was concerned, I'd lost all my family in the last year of the war. My father died and sister had gone to America. I had nowhere to go, so I gave myself a month. I said, I'll stay in England a month. If I haven't connected up within that month, I'm going to put in to emigrate to America to go over to my sister in New York, in America anyway. But the last day of that year, of that month, the last day of that month, I landed a job in a concert party with Bert Waterworth to go to Sidmouth in Devon. And that started me on my theatrical career.
Before we actually explore your theatre career in the interwar period, can we just perhaps just look at the war for a little while longer? Would you say that the war had any personal effects upon you? Anything that changed your life in any way?
Yes, in two or three ways. It made me, I think, I told you one or two fellows I'd hit. It made me more aggressive, more short-tempered, and I told you a long time about butcher's shops. That lasted a long time.
I don't think actually you did mention
that. Yes, I couldn't see bits of meat hanging up because of the time that I buried bits of meat, which were my own comrades. Made me bad-tempered, and that's one or two other things that made me not the bloke that I was. Another thing just come back to me. As a kid, I used to love whistling, but after those one or two things in the trenches, I couldn't whistle. I did discover it for a long time. I thought, I never whistle, and I couldn't. that those awful times, one of them anyway, must have killed all things of whistling. And I have never been able to whistle since. When I used to as a kid, I could whistle with anybody, but I can't whistle after that war. Isn't it funny?
Would you say there are any positive changes in your life to come out of the war?
Well, no. I just dropped in with a concert party and met my girlfriend and...
You hadn't actually mentioned that.
Yeah?
You hadn't actually mentioned that until now.
Well, sort of personal thing. I didn't worry too much about girls during the war. I went to one or two bad houses, but I was never mad about going. But maybe I was getting conscious of sex when I was demobbed. Because in this concert party, there was a very nice, what they call a soprano soubrette. That is a girl who can sing straight songs and funny songs and also do a moderate amount of dancing, not tap, but dancing. And she had a little, very trim little round bottom and a very perky, cheeky face. And before she went on the stage one night in a very abbreviated little costume showing her very rounded bottom, I pinched it as she went past me. That was fatal. Next day I went to tea with her and the deed was done, and sometime after we were married. And of course...
What year would that be?
Eh?
What year would that be?
1920. Yes, because my son was born in 20, and he was born... We were married anyway, before he was born. But that changed all my life. But it wasn't until I was married that I realised that that bloody war had killed a lot of my sense of humour and good temper. I was bad-tempered, and my poor wife suffered from it, and I'd go days without speaking, and no whistling, as I said before. All these things happened from the war. And thank God they're over now. I can't whistle, but I can see the humour of it. I can pass a butcher shop now, and I can go in a butcher shop. But the war did all those things for me and to me, but thank God they're over.
Looking back now to that war, did you feel it was a war that was worth fighting?
No. No, I don't. I've often tried to analyse. Not that I love them, I still don't. Or the Japs. But I hated the Germans in those days. And I can't say I've hated them ever since, but I haven't liked them ever since. And the powers that be, the top brass, they knew nothing about fighting a war. All the generals, all they wanted was to put another 10,000 men in this sector, 10,000 men in this sector, not worrying about whether the sector was safe for 10,000 men to go. And it wasn't, because by tomorrow, half the 10,000 were dead. And none, I can't think of any general in that war that did a power of good for winning the war. They didn't. They immediately chucked it in until the Americans came over, which altered the balance of troops to fight the Germans. The thousands or millions of Americans that came over turned the tide, and of course the Germans had to give in. But I can't look back to our leaders with any great love that they won the war. They didn't.
What did you feel about them at the time? Did you think about them at all?
I didn't think about them at the time. I thought it was the natural thing what they were doing. It's only afterwards that I've come to the conclusion they didn't know what they were doing.
May I just pursue this a little bit and talk about, say, your immediate senior officers. How did you regard those people?
Ah, yes, they were all right. I've nothing against my senior officers. I loved my colonel. I loved my second in command. That's why I became his batman. I loved him No, I can't say I disliked any of them. They were just slightly superior to me, as I thought at that time. Of course, they weren't. I mean, I could have been one of them if I'd wanted to be, but I didn't want to be commissioned and die the next day. I thought I was.
Is that the reason why you didn't want to be
commissioned?
That
is the reason why. When they asked me several times if I would go for a commission, I always had the same answer. I'll go for a commission if you can guarantee that when I'm commissioned, I can go into the Royal Flying Corps. And they said they couldn't guarantee that. It depends how I passed out at the school when I'm commissioned. If they thought I was material for Royal Flying Corps, they would do that. But if I was only material for the trenches, that's what I would be. And I said, well, I'm sorry, but I won't take a commission because I would sooner be a live lance corporal than a dead subaltern.
Why did you want to go into the Royal Flying Corps?
I always wanted to fly. Always wanted to fly. Like both my sons in this next war, both wanted to fly, and both did.
May I just look at two other things concerning the war? Can you recall your attitude towards the other nationalities that you were fighting with? Did you actually fight with Commonwealth troops, for example?
Oh, yes, yes. I rather liked them, yes. the Aussies, the Australians, I thought they were super people. And you couldn't muck them about like you could a British Tommy. You know, you couldn't muck them about.
What do you mean by that?
If we wanted something, we could want. But if the Australians wanted something, you've got to give it to them, or else. I can give you one instance of that. One place somewhere, we were a little bit out at what we call out at rest. And the officers were housed in a big mansion, and the electric light and things were all done by Australian troops. And I think it must have been a holiday or something, but the Australians were in charge of all the lighting. Went to the officers' mess and said, could we have a bottle of whiskey? They said, no, of course not. Whiskey doesn't go to other ranks. I said, oh, sorry, sir, we've got the feeling that the electric light's a bit on the blink. They go back to this place, they turn all the bloody lot off, and of course they got no lights. And they went back and said, sorry, sir, about the lights, but that bottle of whiskey would have done wonders, you know, would have given us pep to... they got their bottle of whiskey. And halfway through the evening again, they're back again. Sir, sorry, but it's still on the blink, you know. If another bottle of whiskey would do it, and they got it. We couldn't do that, not the British troops, but the Aussies could do it. So I always liked them. And the New Zealanders, they seemed such gentlemen after the Aussies. You know, they were rough and ready, the Australians. But the New Zealanders were nice gentlemen, nice blokes. And I loved their hats. They were all different sort of hats to the Australians. That's all. French, well, French were French. Could we be fighting in their country and for them? I liked the French. I'd got fellow feeling because I spoke their language.
Did you come across any of the other Commonwealth troops?
Yes, I did.
Indian
the
troops?
Only other Commonwealth ones. I came across Chinese. They were over there as a labour force, digging trenches or digging this and doing that. All very, very low manual work. And they'd imported a few battalions of these Chinese. But they kept them away from us. They kept them behind barbed wire as if they were prisoners. And
how did you feel about that at the time?
Well, I thought it was wrong, really. But then they wouldn't turn them loose to mingle with us. And we knew that they had in their rations bully beef, see? And we hadn't got much bully beef. But they were very short of... cigarettes, and we'd got plenty. I think it was cigarettes. And I don't know, I went to one of their cages once and said, got any bully beef? Yes, yes. You got cigarettes? He said, yeah, plenty. You cigarettes, me bully beef. And so we used to do a lot of swapping with Chinese and that.
Can you remember whereabouts that was?
No, the slightest idea. No, except that I could see it. And I could see the barbed wire and the fencing, but I couldn't tell you where it was. And Another one I kind of, it's a pity to talk about them really, but somewhere, I think it was Armentieres or somewhere, the we had on our left sector, French, I believe, or that side, we were here, and we had Portuguese, we used to call them the pork and beans, Portuguese, but that way, and they used to dress in blue uniforms, like our RAF now, a blue uniform, but there came a bit of a purge one day, and the Jerrys put the wind up them and started to invade their trenches. Then they ran like stink out of their trenches and left them all empty, and we had to infiltrate along to take over the trenches. They ran like stink. They were very poor soldiers in those days. That was the...
Is that what you felt about them at the time?
That's what we felt.
Do you remember what things were said about them for that?
I never heard anything. That was my personal thing, that they couldn't fight. That was my personal view.
Before we move on to looking at your life in the interwar period, can we just look at the role that religion might have played in your life during the time in the war?
To a certain extent, yes. I can't say, I used to, whenever there was a church parade, I would always go to it. But
what do you mean church parade? Was that?
Well, when we were a little bit out of the line, the padre, they would hold prayer meetings. They would do that, and I always attended those, not in a sacrilegious way, because I thought it was the right thing to do, and I liked it. But the thing that that stuck in my mind in those days, and it's remained with me ever since, is that whatever scrape and danger I got into, I always had a feeling my mother was behind me and was looking after me. And to this day, I still say my mother is watching over me. And some other time, I'll tell you about a seance we had once in my house with a well-known clairvoyant. And my mother came into it then, where my mother said that whatever scrape you get into, I will get you out of. Whatever scrape you have got into in the past, I have always got you out of it. I will always be watching over you. And that has been my religion. I still believe in God. Yes, I do. But I can't, not in a fanatical way, but I say my prayers every night, and I bring every one of mine who are living and all those who are dead, I bring them into it every night, and I won't go to sleep until I've said all my prayers. So that's as far as my religion goes.
In the First World War, were you as religious?
No, I can't say that I was conscious of. Except that I say I would go to church parades, but that's all.
Can we now return to what happened to you after demobbed? I think you mentioned that you got a job in a concert party, and also that you got married by 1920. What happened next?
We stayed in this concert party, my old pal Waterworth and myself. We stayed in that for... Though it was a summer show, it lasted about 7 or 8 months. And then...
Well, where was that show?
That was at Sidmouth in Devon.
Yes,
Sidmouth in Devon. That's right. And when that was over, well, Bert and I, we went our separate ways. I had been offered a tour of East, but I'd got some little while to wait for it, so I had to fill in. I can remember playing to fill in the Aldershot camps. You could play two or three at night. They were, you know, attached to the canteens, and some of the troops, you know, a bit boozy and whatnot. But nearly broke my heart one time. There was one song that I'd been singing in the army concert party and at my Devon concert party, and it was an ace winner. It was one of those songs that people would shout for. They'd let you sing your two songs, then they'd sing, you know, we want this one, we want that one, we want that one
was?
Back.
Hey? Can you remember what the song was?
Yes, Come On Papa. And when I was touring India, I'd sometimes get to a new town, and we go into the hotel, and there's the band playing Come On Papa.
Do you remember the song?
Yes, because my prowess or whatnot had gone ahead of me, and they said, oh, you must get this thing, and you would play it when they arrive. That. But when I say Come On Papa, we were playing, my wife and I, these camps at Aldershot, and I thought, the troops, as the troops used to love it, Come On Papa, they love that. And so I started a song, Ladies and Gentlemen, or Gentlemen Only, that I used to sing in the war, and it was very successful. You would probably like it. It's called Come On Papa, and it's Come On Papa, hop in the motor car, sit by my mom, and hold the hand. Dun, 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 dun. You start the race for me, what they call the boom. I'll be secure for you like a Charlotte Russe. Come on, Papa. And well, anyway, I hadn't got as far as that, but it came from everywhere in the audience. They gave me raspberries and whatnot, and I was heartbroken. My lovely song, Getting Raspberries. I never sang it to troops again.
Hmm. Why do you think it was that they changed their opinion of it? Was it just a
they were, you know, we don't want that sort of stuff. It wasn't their sort anymore. No. But as I say, in the wartime, the concert party, they'd take anything. It was something out of there that used to be in their lives that had been taken out, and it was back, and they both hands had them. No matter what you sang, if you sang a hymn, they would applaud you. But there, see, the war was over, and boozy troops didn't want to know about Come On Papa.
Did you start to change your act from that point on?
Oh, I didn't have to, because very shortly afterwards, I got this job that I was expecting to tour India, Burma, Ceylon.
Could you tell me about that, please?
Well, yes, I had an offer to tour India, Burma, and Ceylon. They wanted a pianist that used to work with me, a lady pianist, Miss Holliday. We met one day in London, and she said, oh, Tommy, are you working? I said, no. She said, well, she said, I'm going to India. Would you like to go? I said, I'd like to very much. She said, well, I'll give you the address. We're going in about a month's time, and they want not a comedian, more of a light comedian. Not a red nose, one, a light, what they call a light comedian. And anyway, get in touch with them. Well, I got in touch with them. Yes, I was the type they wanted, and they said they would pay me at that time £25 a week. Well, that was a fortune in those days. But it was all settled. I would go for 6 months. And I suddenly thought, I said, oh, sorry, I'll have to say no. After all, I can't go because my wife is in hospital. She's had acute appendicitis and very nearly died with a thing. And they said, oh, sorry to hear that. When is she coming out? And I said, well, I don't suppose she'll be out for another week or two yet. And they said, we won't be going for another week or two yet. What does she do? Is she in the business? I said, yes. She's what we call a soprano soubrette. They said, that's just what we want. A girl who can sing nice light songs and a little bit of dancing and double act with the comedian, which is you. That's what we want. Is she good? I said, well, we've been together and working for a long time. Everybody says, what a lovely artist. She said, in that case, we'll take your word for it and we'll book her. So they booked her without seeing her from a hospital bed. Well, anyway, came the time we had to go, and she wasn't. I had to take her out of hospital because where they'd cut her open, it hadn't healed properly, and the last stitch was tied to a big silver safety pin to save it being sucked into her stomach. And, well, anyway, she had to weather that, and we travelled over, because the first day on board ship, the Nyanza, I remember that bloody name too, the Nyanza was the steamship, first class thing, and first day on board, as soon as the ship moved, She was seasick. She was seasick the whole time over. And I was so scared of this titch. But she weathered the storm, and we arrived in Colombo. And that's where we did our first show. And my thing of Colombo is the glorious sunset and the millions of fireflies, which I had never seen in my life before. And anyway, the wife was very thin but very active, and we stayed over there 3 months, I think it was, with a concert party, with a show, and then they had to come back to England. That was the end of their contract. But they said that anybody who wished to stay in the country and perform, they would have to waive their fare back to England, but they would be offered a fair amount of work. So wife and I waived our fare, and we stayed on as a double act. And somebody higher up used to book us all sort of places, a week at Delhi, a week at Hyderabad, a week at Sarsa. They would arrange it, and we'd just go to wherever we were sent. And we stayed on about another 3 or 4 months after that.
Where did you live at this time?
Where?
When you were in India.
Oh, well, that depends on which town you're playing.
Did you stay in hotels?
Oh, that was in our contract. And the original contract is that we had to stay at the first-class hotel. The first-class hotel in every town you went. Because in those days, they were very sticky, the Anglo-Indians. Are they clever? It's where are they staying? And if you said a second-class hotel, oh, well, they can't be so good, can they? But if you said the Taj Mahal hotel, oh, they must be good, mustn't they? And that was it. So in their contract, first-class hotel.
How did you feel about that sort of
attitude? Well, it didn't make any difference to us. Really paid us a little extra to meet these bigger bills.
Having left India after your... Well, actually, how long did you stay on? Well, I don't think we've established that.
Say 3 or 4 or 5 months.
So you're in India for nearly a year?
I suppose. So. Yes, I suppose so, yes.
And what happened then?
Well, we came back to England.
And when you came back to England, what did you do?
Not long before I fixed up in another concert party, a summer concert party at Herne Bay. And there... That starts my life over this side, because Herne Bay and Tankerton is where my family were practically born, and everything happened from there, and I settled there. My son still lives there. I lived there for a long time. That's where we came back from India. We settled in concert party there, and used to go every year to Herne Bay to the show, and then eventually settle there.